From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. The slowdown in the Chinese economy caused financial havoc around the world that included a massive sell-off in stock exchanges. The New York Times said the instability in China exposed, quote, a new reality that China is no longer a safe bet, unquote. 71 dead bodies were found in an abandoned van outside Vienna as the migrant crisis in Europe worsened. In the United States, businessman Donald Trump widened his lead in the race for the Republican presidential nomination in next year's election, and President Obama visited New Orleans, Louisiana, to highlight the city's strong recovery from Hurricane Katrina 10 years ago. Well, David, let me start with you. I've been a little surprised, and I shouldn't be, but I have been, at how many countries were really dependent economically on China for its boom to continue. You know, countries like Brazil were dependent on exports to China.
Australia.
Australia is a good example.
Yeah.
And even the United States auto companies have slowed down their sending of autos to be sold in China. It really is a massive thing. What do you make of the whole deal?
Well, since 2000, there has been one source of comfort if you are a CEO of a big company or you're looking at the global economy, because it was clear that the West was slowing down, aging. Certainly Europe was slowing down. But the emerging markets was what we were all talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India and China, mm-hmm. particularly China, and that as they joined the middle class, this was, you know, not only driving an enormous boom in commodities as they built all these, you know, famous new high-speed railways, gigantic new airports, new roads, you know, and that needed iron ore from places like Australia. So, you know, the Australians have had a gigantic commodities boom. The Brazilians have had a gigantic commodities boom. If you were in the business of extracting oil or gas, you really didn't have to worry about whether there was going to be a customer. You just drilled as much as you could because everyone knew that China was this insatiable source of demand. What I think we're seeing now is, I mean, for one thing, there's a limit to how many new airports you can build. So at some point, the Chinese government knew that it was going to have to shift from this debt-driven infrastructure kind of boom into something more sustainable, something more like a regular country with middle-class people buying stuff. And that was what they were hoping to transition to smoothly. I think that two things have happened this week. One is the kind of the noisy headlines about a crashing stock market in places like the Shanghai stock market. That you should take with a pinch of salt, because actually the Chinese stock market is not, you know, Shanghai is not the New York Stock Exchange. It's a small market. It doesn't really reflect the Chinese economy. The bigger thing that has happened over the last few weeks is that the Chinese government's attempts to prop up the stock market, to forestall some of these falls, were very clumsy and very amateurish. And that, I think, has been the big discovery, the big wake-up for a few people who were sort of in denial. They thought the Chinese government might not be a democracy, but boy, were they good at running their economy. You know, maybe because they weren't a democracy, they were even better at running an economy. You know, an awful lot of big businessmen in the West who sort of quite liked the fact that they weren't a democracy, that they were these hyper-efficient technocrats.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing that they are actually as incompetent as governments everywhere else.
Tom, let me read something more. I quoted from the New York Times. I'm going to read a paragraph from their story of a couple of days ago. And I'll start with this. China, while still at large and a pervasive presence in the global economy, is now exporting uncertainty around the world with the potential for choppier growth and volatile swings. The tectonic shift is forcing a gut check in industries that have built their strategies and plotted their profits around China's rise. Didn't really exactly sound like the New York Times, but it was a gut check.
I think there's an element of truth to that. I think a lot of countries, a lot of governments, and certainly a lot of corporate executives assume that China's economy would grow at 7% a year as it has for quite a while now. But it also appears that the Chinese thought the same thing, and they didn't have a plan B for the inevitable fall off at some point, because that is, I think 7% growth is unsustainable year in and year out forever, and it's caught up with the Chinese. And having all of us have been to China many times, it's even kind of amazing to me that we even use terms like the Chinese stock market, because this is still a country where Chairman Mao's presence is everywhere. But they seem to have come to this in fits and starts, assuming that their prosperity and their growth would go on forever. And there are ripple effects. You're both right. Ripple effects all around the world. I mean, and let's don't forget the hundreds of billions of dollars in U.S. Treasury notes and bonds that the Chinese hold as well. So they are a pivotal economic power, not to mention other things. And any kind of a hiccup in Beijing is going to cause tremors around the world.
Yeah, Tom mentioned, David, that they had no plan B. Countries never have a plan B. When things are going great, they think they'll go forever. I mean, there was not really a plan B in the United States when the stock market crashed in late 2008. Well, you wind up with a recession often.
I mean, actually, if you're going to get kind of into the details of this, the rise of the stock market in recent years was an attempt at a plan B. It wasn't a plan B that was very good for regular Chinese. Because what you had was over the years, I mean, I was based in China a decade ago, and I saw the kind of the beginning of this infrastructure boom. You saw state-owned banks basically under huge pressure to lend unlimited amounts of money to, say, you know, some mid-sized city in the middle of nowhere to build some gigantic international airport. That kind of debt-driven growth ultimately had to sort of stop. And so they were worried about the health of their banks. They didn't want the banks to keep lending indefinitely to all of these companies, but they needed these banks to have access to cheap money. So the government started this enormous propaganda campaign to tell ordinary Chinese that it was their patriotic duty and they would make a fortune if they stuck their money in the stock exchange. And you've had these stock exchanges, which were basically casinos, where ordinary regular Chinese punters looked in the Chinese newspapers, and they weren't trying to bet on whether a company was healthy or an unhealthy company or had a good business model. They tried to bet on whether they thought that company had good political connections. And so they would scan the newspapers for kind of a positive article about that company. Chinese newspapers, which are also deeply corrupt, they're owned by the Communist Party, but they'll bribe journalists to write nice things about them. And so you've actually seen this flood of money into the Chinese stock exchanges from regular mom-and-pop investors who have, in the last few days, seen their life savings wiped out. And that has very, very big political consequences because they were told to put their money in by the Communist Party.
Tom, that sounds a little like what happened in the United States in 2008, actually. Anyway, let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with David Rennie and Tom DeFrank. David, let's turn to the migrant crisis in Europe and the 71 people found in a van with their decomposed bodies is an example of what can happen. I think something like 2,300 people have died trying to get to Europe, mainly from Africa and the Middle East, in the last year. It is hard to get to Europe. I mean, they have a different problem than the U.S. We have a problem here with illegal immigration. It's a lot easier to get across the border. It's harder to get across the Mediterranean or to get from Turkey into the Balkans.
Well, it's a completely different political problem. I think it's a gigantic political problem that Europe is only beginning to wrestle with. I think the simple answer is what's going on. At the end of the Second World War, the rich Western developed world agreed that refugees had a protected status, and they agreed the Geneva Refugee Convention, that if you were subject to political or religious persecution or ethnic persecution, you could be given a safe haven. The problem with that promise was it was made, and it was a good promise, it was a moral promise, and it was quite understandable after the horrors of World War II. That promise was made at a time when it was physically hard for people to come and cash in that check. It was physically hard for most of the world's oppressed to turn up in downtown Paris or downtown London or downtown Berlin. Now, for all kinds of reasons to do with globalization, to do with, you know, cheap air travel, to do with even things like GPS, you know, these migrants no longer need navigation help to get across the Mediterranean. They just use their smartphones. GPS can get a small boat from one side of the Mediterranean to the other. And you have this gigantic number of people in places like sub-Saharan Africa for whom it's no longer an outlandish possibility to turn up on the doorsteps of Europe. And so I think the political promise made to refugees is out of kilter with the number of people who are trying to take up that promise. And so I think that we're going to see over the next few years an absolutely gigantic argument about whether actually we believe our promise about refugees at all.
Tom?
Well, as David suggests, this problem is going to get far worse before it gets better, if it ever gets better. There was a graphic in the Washington Post recently that showed that more than 300,000 migrants, refugees, however you want to describe them, have entered Europe via sea this year in 8 months, and there were only something like 220,000 all of last year. Germany has already committed to 800,000 refugees this year. It's just becoming harder and harder for these governments to deal with it. Hungary especially has become very hard line on this. You have the spectacle of Hungarian government erecting hundreds of miles of fences with razor-sharp concertina barbed wire at the top, and you have pictures in the media of little kids trying to fight their way through the barbed wire. It is heartbreaking, but to put it mildly, the turmoil in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Turkey is not going to get better anytime soon. One of the ironies is one of the first stops for many of these displaced people is Greece, which is, to put it mildly, ill-equipped to handle anywhere near the influx of migrants or refugees that are heading their way. So I think very belatedly, European governments, especially wealthier ones like Germany and France, are finally beginning to realize that you have to have a coordinated and coherent policy across Europe to deal with an influx of this magnitude.
But my own country, Britain, at the moment has hundreds of migrants, not thousands, not tens of thousands, hundreds of migrants, very visibly fighting to get through the Channel Tunnel that links France and the UK. This is triggering an outbreak of the most kind of rabid xenophobic rhetoric from politicians, even from mainstream parties, as if the whole country is under invasion. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, talking about swarms of people as if they're insects. Just hundreds of people, whereas there are other countries, as Tom says, facing tens of thousands of people. But the British are in this, you know, unbelievable kind of hostile mood. An asylum seeker has become a term of abuse. I mean, asylum seeker is now the equivalent of kind of criminal. It's a very ugly kind of xenophobia that's spreading across Europe at the moment.
If you were going to deport all these migrants, where would you send them to? You can't send them back to Syria. There's a state of war there.
Well, that's the problem. So you have in the world of refugee policy, you have prima facie refugees who come from a place so bad that you have to assume that the starting assumption is that there probably are refugees. One of the other wrinkles in European policy is that countries in the top left-hand corner of Europe, which tend to be quite rich, like the UK, like Sweden, all these countries, they have benefited enormously from an agreement that was signed in different times, which was that the first European Union country that a refugee came to, they were obliged to declare that they were refugees and seek asylum in that country, and it was up to that country to deal with them. And if they then tried to make their way further into Europe, they could be sent back to that first entry point. So the bottom right-hand corner of Europe was like flypaper for refugees. And you have, I mean, Greece has got a big problem. Malta, which is a tiny island but also a sovereign country in its own right, is right on the maritime route from Libya to Italy. So the Maltese, I went and did a story there a few years ago, the Maltese get boatload after boatload in a country, you know, the size of, you know, it's probably smaller than Rhode Island, and it gets, you know, these gigantic numbers. Under European law, they're all obliged to stay in Malta. They're not allowed to leave Malta.
Malta part of the EU?
Malta is part of the EU, and it's a sovereign country, even though it's tiny. I mean, it's a few hundred thousand
people. So presumably, if you get there, you're allowed to go, to go other countries.
No, that's the point. You can't. The rule is that you have to stay in the first country you hit.
That's what I mean. Without that rule, but a lot of them leave anyway.
Yeah, because there's no borders. Because one of the great things about Europe was they dismantled the borders. But it turns out that that's problematic when it's people you don't want.
Well, another thing that is happening is that many of these first countries of disembarkation, I suppose, are looking the other way and handing many of these, thousands of these individuals transit visas and letting them go to the next country.
Absolutely, you know, absolutely. Right? Yeah. In fact, the head of the Maltese Navy, well, the military, because they've only got one service because it's so small, told me that they just hand them a jerry can of petrol, say, Italy's that way, you know, keep going. That's what they do.
Okay. Time for another break. We'll be right back with Issues in the News.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with Tom DeFrank and David Rennie, and we're going to turn to the subject of Donald Trump, also known as the Donald, known to the people who work for him as Mr. Trump. Tom, what about Donald Trump? He's a businessman. He seems to break all the rules that politicians normally follow in running for president. You know, they try to be so dignified, or they used to, and Donald Trump, insults people and then calls the other candidates losers, or they're stupid, or they're morons, and sends tweets to attack people in the media, especially Megyn Kelly of Fox News. Why is he doing so well? He's now over 30% support among likely Republican voters in the primaries and caucuses next year.
Well, I think it's simply, Fred, that he is tapped into a rising sense of discontent, especially in the Republican base. I mean, I've been hearing about this for months from people who say, I like Ted Cruz because, yes, he's crazy. Yes, the Republicans can't stand him. Yes, he'll never be elected president. Mm-hmm. But
Ted Cruz is a senator from Texas.
One of the earlier announced candidates, I think. But Donald Trump is all of the above. He's flamboyant. He's wealthy. And you're right, he seems to have broken all the rules and lots of crockery in the process. He has not, he's refusing to commit to not run as an independent if the Republican Party doesn't treat him well. He's so far refused to say that he will endorse any Republican if he is not the Republican nominee himself. I think it's one of those summer flings. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to believe that Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States. He's just too out there. But his numbers in the Republican Party are rising, not falling, and it is quite a phenomenon. He is an outlet for protests. He's an outlet for voters who believe that even Republican leaders in Washington are part of the problem, not part of the solution. He's a magnet for people who say conventional politicians have failed us, even conservative conventional politicians have failed us, and we want somebody totally different, and that's certainly what Mr. Trump offers.
Yeah, David, he's certainly taken advantage of that split in the Republican Party that Tom talked about, where the grassroots of the Republican Party, you've talked to people outside Washington, and they think that the worst thing in Washington are their own leaders, Mitch McConnell in the Senate and John Boehner in the House.
That's right, but what's so amazingly cynical and effective of Donald Trump is he doesn't promise to clean up Washington. He doesn't offer reform at all. He says, you're right, Washington's completely broken, it's completely corrupt, they're all dummies, they're all stupid, but he doesn't promise a smaller government or this piece of reform or that reform. He just goes, you stick me in charge, like a kind of Mussolini figure, and I'll just, I don't need their money, so the corruption can't touch me. I'll just, I'll short-circuit the system. And I think what's important to do is to try and look at, I mean, the early polls are hard because, they're not the best opinion polls. Look at who his voters are. And, there is quite a lot of evidence now that the core of his vote is white, older men with not much education. These are the same people who in Europe are voting for far-right parties and far-left parties. And what we know about these people, that's not all of who it is, but that's the core of his vote. What do we know about these people is politicians can't give them what they want, because what a lot of them want is the past back. Because if you are a working-class white guy in your sort of 50s or 60s living in the middle of America, when you were a young man, you could leave high school and get a job for life in the local factory. And black people knew their place. They were not your equals. They would step off the sidewalk. Your wife knew her place because women were not as economically powerful as you were. And now you're the victim of globalization because those factory jobs have gone to China. You're the victim of automation because a robot can do your job. Your wife doesn't know her place because actually she's more economically valuable than you are because she can get a better job than you can. There's a black man in the White House, and so he doesn't know his place. So you're mad as hell about your loss of social and economic power, And he's very effective at tapping into that, I think.
I think he's tapped into more than that. I don't quite agree with that analysis. I went to a focus group of 29 Trump supporters of one kind or another, organized by Frank Luntz, who's been doing these things for years. And these were more middle-class people. There were some working-class people, more middle-class, even a few Democrats, even people who'd voted twice for Obama. And they loved Trump. It was amazing to find they cut him all kinds of slack no matter what he does. When he doesn't have any specifics, as you were suggesting, David, they don't seem to mind that. They love the swagger and the attitude and the insults and all that. It's amazing to me, but there it is.
It's extraordinary, but I just don't know how sustainable it can be. On the other hand, Trump is finally organizing. I mean, he's got the money. He's worth billions of dollars, and he's organizing in Iowa. He's organizing in New Hampshire, and he seems to be doing pretty well there. And if he wins a couple of the early votes, early caucus and primary states like Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada, he could have a head of steam here. But I think in terms of the overall impact, the strategic impact is to push the Republican Party further to the right. I remember that after President Obama was reelected to a second term, there was a political autopsy done by the Republican Party, and its national leader said, okay, we messed up. Here's what we've got to do. We've got to quit picking fights with women. We've got to quit picking fights with African Americans.
Yeah, it said moving to the left is what
right.
they said.
Right, and we got to quit picking fights with Hispanics. Well, the party at the moment in the guise of Mr. Trump is more or less picking fights with all those groups, especially Hispanics. So Trump, that's one of his few specifics. He said of the 11 million illegal aliens, he says they all have to go home. We have to send them home, and that's not exactly going to help him with the Hispanic vote, which he is convinced he will win the majority of.
Even though polls show him that Hispanics disapproving of him by, you know, the margins of 6-1 and or 7-1 percentages of that, it's quite amazing. Why have we been, I admit, I have been wrong about Trump's durability as a candidate. You know, he was below 20% in support among Republicans before, and everybody thought that was it. And he insults John McCain, the senator from Arizona, and people say, well, boy, he's blown it now, and so on. And that was a couple months ago, and he's continued to bail. Why have we been, so many people who write and think about politics have been wrong about Trump's strength as a candidate, at least as we see it now?
Well, I think part of it is we just don't actually understand or even really admire the people. We don't really respect the people who like Trump. So it's very hard for us to kind of think like them. And, you know, there's an element of, you know, I spend an awful lot of my time at Republican rallies talking to voters. And, you know, I'm fairly kind of irritated that I've spent, you know, the last several years having people telling me how the one thing that matters to them more than anything else is, say, biblical values, and they're values voters, and nothing matters to them more than a man's kind of moral character. And then those same evangelical voters in the polls, they're like Trump. Yeah. So it turns out that everything those people shouted at me when I was writing it down in my notebook, they were just full of hooey. I mean, it was nonsense. Turns out they don't mean that stuff. Mm-hmm. I think what's also interesting is Tom is clearly right that they're forcing the Republican rivals to the right. But the irony of ironies is that he's not actually proposing very right-wing policies on a whole bunch of things. I mean, his trick is to be a nationalist.
Except on immigration.
Yeah, so his trick is, it seems that the one thing that people really, really like is that he's extremely rude about certain foreigners.
Yeah.
And particularly foreigners who Americans think are kind of taking America for a ride. It's that kind of, you know, if we're the world's greatest country, how come these guys are taking us for a ride and don't seem to respect us? And that's his shtick, is to say, we're going to be tougher on them, nastier on them, and I can make America the boss again. That's a kind of very pure, kind of Jacksonian kind of impulse, I think.
Well, we've run out of time here, and we can't talk about New Orleans, which has had a very strong recovery now, particularly with its school system and so on, and partly thanks to the Democratic mayor there. A great recovery, but that's all the time we have. And joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.